This is the August 3 edition of Commodity Week.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Well, welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. Our panelists for the day include Dave Chatterton. He's at Strategic Farm Marketing in Champaign, Illinois. Aaron Curtis joins us from Midco in Bloomington, Illinois. And Ellen Dearden is here from AgriFuel out of Morton, Illinois. Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world. Online at willag.org and look for us in your favorite podcast applications. Ellen Dearden, let's begin with you. Do you have a list we should use for the day, please?
Next Friday, August 11th, is the USDA crop report. And typically we would think about August being the first real significant numbers of production. But given that USDA doesn't send their own people into the field and relies on farmer surveys, how will people look at this August report, and will they buy into any numbers that USDA puts out?
Aaron Curtis, things that we should talk about for the day?
Corn and wheat look pretty heavy to me still, and I'm just curious, what are some things maybe that we can look for here as we head towards harvest that may change my mind on making this corn market or wheat market perk up a little bit? And is there any bullish things out there that we can hang our hat on here heading into harvest?
Dave, I really want to ask you that question, but let's get your list first. What's on it?
Yeah, Todd, I think I maybe I'll twist a little bit off of both what Ellen and Aaron had to say. And I think when you look ahead at the crop report coming up, certainly that's the next kind of major data point for the market. But to this point, we've had two major drivers. One's been weather, one's been the Black Sea, both almost impossible to predict or with any certainty, and then a lot of ups and downs in that. And with that, Todd, we've got some volatility here in the futures market. It's almost been incredible the way this thing has gone up and down, the ranges that we've traded, the high to low, we're going nothing but down or nothing but up. And I think it's left farmers a little bit confused. And when we look at that report, and Owen talks about the data and how, you know, the trade is going to look at that. Unfortunately, when we look at what drives that volatility, it's typically money flow. When I say money flow, I'm talking about managed money, large funds, and big traders in the marketplace. And they do trade that data and, you know, do so without much of a bias. So I think it's, you know, important for maybe producers to understand how that money flows in and out, what it looks at, and what that means for volatility, and how that parlays into the risk management for them on a per acre P&L basis, let's say.
Well, let's start there. Can you give me a sense of how that information is developed and how the money moves through the marketplace and why?
Yeah, Todd, I think when you look at these large money managers and you're talking, you know, if you put it in context, if you look at the global commodity markets in general, and we won't break this down into grains, but all commodities, so oils, metals, meats, you know, pull in all the things that you can look at on a global basis, and you compare that to the global equity and bond trade, there's like a 60x difference there in the size or the capital that's moving in those markets currently, the notional value of those markets. So when we see money flow, you know, starting back and forth, going between the equity and bond market and into the commodity market, and, you know, who's got the hot market back and forth, it could be an overwhelming function or overwhelming, I should say, volume of capital that comes in and out of our markets. Primarily the drivers of who's pushing money in and out and where that money goes, it can get very detailed. But it tends to run more on a technical base, and it tends to run more on a sector base or a wider view than we're looking at, hey, just what's the U.S. corn yield or did it rain in Iowa and different things like that. So, you know, when those triggers get pulled, so let's say a 200-day moving average or a technical, you know, formation on a chart that points to a buy or sell and that money starts to move in, it does so in a way that, like I said, creates the amount of volatility. Wheat's a great example of what we've had. If you look at the last, well, I'll say 6 weeks in wheat, you've had two instances of a $1.30 rally and a $1.30 decline twice in the last 6 weeks. You traded a 50-cent range just yesterday in wheat. And, you know, we talk more about corn and beans, but certainly that's indicative of kind of what's going on. So those decisions that get made aren't necessarily you know, keying off that they're looking at a large data set where they can move a large amount of capital based on an idea. And when you talk about who has the best data in the world in terms of agriculture, it's the USDA. And that we want to parse and pick at the USDA and think their numbers are wrong or that they're going to go this direction or that, those numbers are generally accepted in terms of how they go into a computer modeling system and an algorithm and what it spits out for these large traders, Todd.
Ellen Dearden, I'd like to follow up on this subject just a little bit, on the idea that while the volatility is there, and Aaron Curtis can jump in on this as well, the marketplace, the futures are designed to find a price where grain will move. It's not, I think, and maybe Dave, I'm reading this wrong from you as well, it's about the range, but not really the price itself. I guess that's right. And Ellen, I suppose that's a question for Dave to answer, but do you have thoughts on what he's talked about?
Well, the futures market is futures and ideas about what's upcoming. And the funds like to trade futures. They're not trading cash. The cash market is really the reflective of the current situation with fundamentals. So you've got to throw in the basis along with futures if you're to understand the fundamentals or what that means. And I think the basis situation that we've seen all summer in grains has been very much out of sync with the last several years of basis. And that's primarily because the futures have been so jumpy and volatile.
Out of sync in what way?
I don't think that we are seeing, just for example, on the bean side of things, we've seen processor bids of a dollar over regularly on the spot market over the futures. And yet the futures have had pretty significant moves. However, the basis fell apart over the last week's time in the Western Corn Belt and lost 80 cents in a very short period of time. Did the futures market reflect that? Yes, a little bit, but in the nearby months, but not in the back months. So I think we've got different situation because of the money flow coming in and out of these big, big funds into and out of equities, into bonds and out of bonds and into the commodities. We need to keep thinking, like Dave pointed out, that these money flows work in sectors. So when we talk about funds we're buying in the grain futures, they may have been buying every grain. Maybe they were selling every grain, but they're pretty much into sectors, not into just one individual thing like corn or meal or something along that line.
Aaron, let me return to you then. Are there issues within basis that you see across the elevator systems?
Yeah, you know, I think in our world, right, basis is going to be a better arbitrator of supply and demand than futures in today's environment, right? It's typically basis and spreads and futures, and that's how that pecking order tends to go on how tight or how burdensome things go. I think partly some of the volatility is in futures is more the illiquid part of the market. It just doesn't seem like we have some days where there's just not big volume days. So if you come in with a pretty sizable order, right, it doesn't take a lot to push it around. And we've had big instances over the last year where the farmer just disappears for large periods of time. And so you take that hedging component out of it, you know, it doesn't take as much to move some of these markets around. Now we've had some bigger volume days, especially when it pertains to what maybe some changes in the Black Sea region. But we've gone some periods of time here where we just don't have a lot of volume of what you would expect a normal market to have. So I think more the illiquidity of the market tends to add to those wider ranges some of these days, in my opinion. And we've had some pretty volatile spreads as well. I mean, we've had days where the spread has traded wider than the futures market. So that has also been part of that function, right, of rolling positions or whatever that the funds do. And it's just have just some days when you just wonder where some of the volume's at.
It's so the lack of farmers in the marketplace and hedging, is that because they don't feel comfortable with the old, new crop prices and they're out of old crop?
That's part of it. And part of it, you know, we went back through that May timeframe, early June timeframe when the market was pretty depressed. And, you know, when you're used to selling $6, $7, $8 corn, right? You're not so excited about selling $5 corn, right? So you just go through long periods where just not a lot of interest. We did see some participation when we had that dollar rally in corn in mid to late June. And then, you know, we took it away as fast as we got it. And then it kind of died down again. But, you know, we're estimating farmers sold, you know, roughly 10 to 12% on a whole for an average across the Midwest on new crop. And that's below recent averages anyway. So the farmer has a lot of marketing to do here as we move to harvest. And my guess is if prices stay in this level or lower, we're going to see beans sold across the scale this fall and corn held on to and see what happens post-harvest.
Now, prior to the time that we started our conversation, I told you all that we were doing this just a little differently and have given each of you kind of a topic area to take up. Aaron's topic area is the cash marketplace. Ellen, do you have a question for Aaron about the cash market?
Yeah, I do. If we're going to see heavy farmer sales of beans in the fall and farmers holding on to corn, are we going to see a quick snapback in the basis in this December-January time period? And I'm talking both corn and soybeans.
The factors we need to consider, A, is the inverted market structure that we've had all year, right, has largely left the commercial grain system fairly empty in harvest. I mean, we're going to be emptier even probably than we've had the last couple years. So, you know, harvest pressure, so to speak, is not going to necessarily be an issue, at least, you know, at least early on in harvest, which tends to pressure basis, right, especially if we can't find a home for it. So that's going to be relieved. The farmer selling as well, right? Typically, a farmer sells much, you would think that they would appreciate or weigh on basis as well. And I think you're going to take a couple of those factors out. So I think that we're going to see some instances. It won't be necessarily overall the Midwest, because we're still going to have some areas that are going to have some pretty sizable production. But I think you'll see some instances where we'll see some basis appreciation to try to move some of that grain that the farmer's not interested in selling. You know, we're continuing to put some board carry back in the market here today. We've got Dece March at, you know, the widest we've had all year at 13 and a half cents. So interest costs are going to be big for the commercial grains elevator system, but we're starting to put a little carry back in the corn market, so that might prompt a little more corn off the market here as we move into that fall period. But really, basis is going to come down to exports. Right now, the export program is poor, and it's not very good. Argentina and Brazil both are priced cheaper than us all the way out through fall. Argentina, you know, initiated this new peso dollar program for corn at the first of the month, or excuse me, first middle of last month. And, you know, they've had some interest. Roughly 6 million metric tons of corn has been sold. So they're cheaper than us on the export front. We know Brazil has had got a big crop, and they seem to be pretty committed to shipping corn out October forward. So I think the USDA today is too high on their export number for next year. And that pull that we typically see from the export market, or we have seen the last couple of years, I just don't think it's going to be there early in the season. And that's going to tend to kind of weigh on basis levels more than what we've seen, you know, since 2020.
Dave Chatterton, you have a question for Aaron?
Yeah, Aaron, I guess when we look at the situation here of how this basis has played out and the deficit that we had in the West this year, has that been solved? Has that East-West pull, you know, been solved in terms of how it will affect our basis here, let's say in the core of the Midwest or in Central Illinois?
Yeah, so we had a big BN pull on the BN rail from the western side of Illinois right out to Kansas, Texas, Colorado, Nebraska, out to those areas, because, you know, obviously with the drought last year, they had to pull corn further east, and that was a big benefit from the Illinois market, because, you know, Illinois typically has excess corn, right? We've been able to go a lot of different directions with that, so that's been a benefit this last year. But, you know, if you add in the Dakotas, Nebraska, Kansas, and Texas, we're looking at, right, if you use some of the kind of the basis numbers that some folk, or excuse me, this started to put out now, you're looking at, you know, roughly 650 million bushels more corn available to the market in those five states versus a year ago. Now, we've got some weather to go, right? We're not got the crop made by any stretch of the imagination, but it definitely looks considerably better out there. Obviously, more rain in the west. So that BN poll to the west is going to be muted compared to what we had a year ago. So that'll leave more corn in the state to have to continue with. And then you throw in the fact that less of it may go down the Illinois River because of a poor export system. It probably tells you basis overall, it's not going to be as good as what we saw a year ago.
So Ellen Dearden, as Aaron has stated, if those five states are going to produce more corn, which they will because of the drought, or they should because of better weather conditions this year, and the herd size of beef cattle is smaller this year, what problems does that create for the Midwestern farmer in Iowa, Illinois, and places east?
Well, the rail program that went out of Western Illinois, for example, which many in this area thought would last the entire summer, has already dried up, and the rail market that's going west is going west-south into Mexico. So that hurts basis in Western Illinois. It hurts basis in Iowa. But movement of corn always takes place. So we're always moving corn to where it's needed or whatever, you know, whether we're going to feed Milo or whatever. And keep in mind that the western part of Kansas is extremely green. So they're going to have corn to feed. They're going to have Milo to feed. The same goes for western Nebraska. The beef herd is considerably less. I mean, all cattle herd is 95.7 million head, according to the last cattle inventory report. So it seems to me that maybe the bigger question on the cattle side of things is, where are the cow-calf people that typically, you know, Missouri is a huge cow-calf state. It remained dry until the last couple of weeks. So we didn't see, we've seen selling off of those cows. So we're seeing a heavy amount of placements going into feedlots. And keep in mind that when we get those monthly cattle on feed reports, they're showing placements into big feedlots. I think what we're seeing is maybe a shift into some farmer feeders in the Midwest trying to use up last year's corn and also pulling some of that corn that came out of Iowa and Illinois into those farmer feeder situations where they're feeding a couple hundred head of or have a couple hundred head on feed at all times. So I think we've made some shifts in what we're doing with cattle, but part of that is less corn, more Milo, less corn, more wheat, and that probably will change once we get past corn harvest.
Aaron Curtis, do you have questions for Ellen about the livestock sector?
I guess kind of along the same lines, Ellen, what do you think it takes to start to rebuild the herd for some of those, I want to say, smaller folks, right? Is it continued cheaper feed costs for a longer period of time? Is it just take time? How do you see this? Because I look at futures markets, right, pretty strong out through at least April of next year, and then maybe tail off a little bit. But what's it going to take, you think, to start to rebuild cattle herds, or do we? I mean, is this the new norm, I guess, for some of these lower numbers?
I don't know that we're going to rebuild very quickly because of higher interest costs is a big factor. We've got to have a crop this year and we've got to get it in the bin or, you know, accessible to that feeder. So I think we have continued to put off the rebuilding of this herd for another 6 months just because of higher interest costs.
Can I follow up with a statement and maybe a question again for you, Ellen? In Illinois, I know southern Illinois has been the primary place where there would be smaller beef cattle herds. The extension folks who service that area have told me for a couple of years now that those producers are retiring and nobody's filling that gap. I suspect that probably is the case across the whole of the Midwest. Will the large feeders pick up that number of cattle? I'm thinking you're telling me probably not.
I would think probably not. And that's why, what's one big reason why we're not going to rebuild this herd very easily?
Dave Chatterton, a question?
Yeah, I mean, Todd, I think you hit it on the case, and maybe more a little bit more of a comment to what Ellen and Aaron have already brought out. And I think the rebuilding of this herd takes years, not months. And when you look at the futures market, I think that it recognizes that, to Aaron's point. So cheaper corn certainly going to help, but the incentive for, you know, these producers to start holding back heifers and rebuilding that herd, which takes time, takes investment in a higher interest rate market. You know, the fundamentals of the underlying cattle market, or the front end fed cattle supply, if you want to put it in those terms, you know, absent a pretty big economic upset, looks pretty strong for a number of months going forward. And, you know, the overall effect that has, you know, on the grain markets, I guess I can throw it back to the other two panelists, but that's really, I think, what we're curious about.
And so then, Ellen, just to be clear, beef cattle in consumption of corn would be number three behind poultry and hogs. And this would be a subset which has disappeared or is disappearing. And then, of course, there was the drought out west, which caused beef cattle to come out of the marketplace, or not to be replaced, I suppose, into the feedlots as well, or the cow-calf herd, that is. That means corn has to stay put somewhere. You say it moves all the time, but I guess it doesn't have to. Is that right?
Well, it has to if there's demand from a different area. And I think we ignore, at least in this area, we ignore that poultry is a huge consumer of corn. And those numbers, it seems to me, those numbers can go up rather quickly.
And it's not as far away either. That's Minnesota for the turkey flocks for sure. Arkansas and then to the southeast as well. Well, let's transition to one other topic area. And I think, Dave Chatterton, if you could talk a little bit about ethanol consumption production and what you believe it looks like going forward.
Yeah, Todd, I think if I throw up your question a little bit and we kind of go back on what Ellen talked about, obviously the feed component is a big, you know, we're talking, you know, just under 40% of the overall corn demand. Ethanol is right there and just a little bit bigger than that, and then exports and the rest of the show. So when we look at and focus specifically on ethanol, you know, looking at this week's EIA production figures, just a little bit disappointing, kind of dropping week over week. And we've seen what I'll call pretty decent production numbers of late, but we're starting to show just a few cracks here when we look at that domestic demand side. Producer margins have been decent. They've been supportive here, but corn use for ethanol is, you know, coming up just short of where it was a year ago. So the USDA's 22-23 projection is about 100 million bushels below the previous year, or a loss of 100 million bushels in demand, at about 2%. Marketing year to date, we've crushed about 4.28 billion bushels of corn for ethanol. It's down from about 4.5 last year, or down about 3.8% at this point. And that puts overall usage kind of on a seasonal trajectory, or implied usage figure against the USDA, it's coming up at about 50 to 55 million bushels below that current USDA projection. So I think the trade is viewing the miss here on ethanol as on the downside, or on the low side, on the under. That doesn't mean that it's a big miss. Maybe it's 20 million, 25 million, but it looks like that number could be adjusted as we go forward. Stocks, on the other hand, of domestic ethanol here, you know, they remain pretty robust here. Third highest at this point for the marketing year in the history in the database that we have. So looking ahead, there seem to be a few challenges, Todd. A particular interest here is, you know, gasoline demand in the U.S. kind of going through what I'll call a bit of a strange stretch here. The last 4 weeks have been, you know, we've been above average all year until the last 4 weeks, and all of a sudden we've taken this big drop, fallen well below normal, and a notable decline from where we were earlier in the year. And I think you can point to a number of different things to kind of get to why that's happening, but it seems like we're disrupting the normal seasonal pattern just a little bit here. So I think from the demand side on the ethanol and what it means to corn usage, you know, not a big miss here, but I do think the miss is pointing to the under. If you look at the export side of demand for ethanol, Todd, it's, you know, it's the smaller piece. It's well below 10% of the overall offtake of ethanol. It's a steadier piece for us at the moment here, but just not enough there to really move the needle very much.
Any questions from the two of you, Aaron?
Dave, do you think the U.S. is still using over 5 billion bushels of corn for ethanol 10 years from now?
That's a great question, Aaron. And I think the answer X a change in our farm bill right now or the renewable fuels policy is probably not. You know, we are seeing a big push to a renewable or to a green energy agenda, but that green energy agenda seems to be on the other side of the fence. In other words, it seems to be more electric than it does, you know, renewable biofuels. And we've got a push for sustainable aviation fuel. The biodiesel industry is a whole nother thing, but gasoline demand in the U.S. has flattened and looks like it's probably going to go lower. Now, it hasn't gone as low as some people had thought, but with the advent of socioeconomic, you know, just changes in the way people live and how they travel and remote work, with more fuel efficient, you know, gasoline engines, and with the advent of the EV, you know, sector of the transportation industry, all of those things point to lower gasoline demand, or at least flatter gasoline demand going forward. So when you look at our number one, you know, component of demand on that side of the fence, Aaron, I think it's a great point. When you look 5 and 10 years down the road, the question is, what are we going to do with that stuff? At one point, China was going to be the saving grace. They needed to get their air quality control under, you know, control, and use ethanol as a big part of that. That's not developed. They've built more coal plants. They've built, you know, more mines, more of the things. And, you know, ethanol in their sense is a way to get rid of excess corn, which they at times have, at times don't, but isn't a big industry for them. So I think it's a definite crack in the armor going forward in terms of what we're, you know, where we're looking at for U.S. corn demand.
I'm kind of riled up about the politics of this whole thing. It seems to me that the clean energy people have ignored ethanol, and I'm not sure what it's going to take to get that back on the fore, especially with Senator Grassley out of Iowa retiring.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's our biggest risk. When you look at the Ag and the House Ag Committee, and, you know, currently some discussions underway about the Farm Bill and the chance that it may even get done here this year before we go to the break. But when you look at the committee members that are moving in and out of that, the old school agricultural state people are gone. And the head of that agricultural committee right now is from Atlanta, Georgia, and is a very metro, type of a mentality, doesn't probably understand farming. The need for the farm bill, doesn't understand crop insurance and all of the things that you're talking about. So if you spin out of that, it goes right into the next agenda, which is the RFS and what that means for agricultural's place in this green revolution. And I wish I had a better and a more specific answer to the question, but, you know, how we're going to do that, I think, remains to be seen. We've got a very good lobbying group traditionally on the ag side in Washington, but I think the changing nature of the Congress, just like the changing demographics of the U.S., puts a little bit of a dent in the question mark in that.
Now, let's move on to a couple of other topics. How difficult, Ellen, will it be for USDA to suss out from the surveys that farmers have filled out or are still filling out and will give back to them for next week's crop production report an accurate number? And, of course, they'll be using satellite imagery as well to come up with those yields.
I think they will see fewer farmer surveys filled out and returned. That's my first thing. So they're going to have a smaller sample. They do their own massaging of that data. So it falls back into USDA to make assessments of farmer data. Using the satellite imagery may be still years away on how that kind of lines up. But I think we have to just say USDA is going to come out with a number, and you got to go with it.
Another question I was hoping that we might be able to answer, and I'll post this to you, Dave Chatterton. The United States has had a difficult time with China. Mostly because there is a battle to see which will be the economic power on the planet in the coming decades. For the last two presidential terms, Donald Trump and Joe Biden, this has damaged trade, of course, with China going both ways. The United States wanting trade coming this way to come from other places and concerned of for all kinds of reasons, but agricultural trade was primarily what was flowing out of the United States to China. How much of a problem is this in export demand?
Well, it's certainly a concern, Todd, and I think when you look at the agricultural export side of it, and specifically with China, what the trade wars have done have been to shift what was already a very strong preference of China to go elsewhere besides the United States as their first choice for imports, and move that even further, you know, down to the end of the spectrum. And so, in China's eyes, we, you know, in a sense, become the importer or the supply of last resort in terms of where they are want to go for their exports. You can see that in the initiatives that they've had with Brazil and Argentina. And other places around the world, the capital and the investments that they're making in the infrastructure in Brazil and the different things that are going on. And, you know, when you take it, maybe just take bean, you know, demand as an example. I mean, right now there's not enough beans in South America to satisfy all of China's demand unless every bean, you know, goes that direction. But at some point we continue to see Brazil have, you know, arable ground that they can expand to and continue to expand their production and capture more and more and more market share. So when you're talking about a U.S. customer, you're talking about China being 60% of the global soybean market, and you're also talking about them being more or less 60% of the U.S. export, you know, market for soybeans. So it's a very important question going forward here. When you look at, you know, Chinese soy demand in you know, 2000 was 13 million metric tons. In 2013, it was 70. This year, it's around 100. You match that up with what's happened in Brazil, and their soybean production in 2000 was around 16 million metric tons. In 2013, it was 46. In 2023, it's going to be about 98 million metric tons. So you have things here that, you know, they're exports. You have things here that are, you know, again, continue to kind of work against us in the big picture. And what it's done is strengthen our export competitors. And I think that trade war combined with what's happened with the dollar all, you know, spell some clouds on the horizon here. I don't want to be a naysayer. We still have a very active market. We have a profitable U.S. farmer. We want to keep it that way. But I think we have to be aware of these things going forward in terms of what we expect out of prices and profitability.
Aaron Curtis, I'll ask you a question you may not be comfortable with, and the others can jump in on this. But should farmers think about marketing any of the next year's crop, and second, about what that crop rotation mix might look like, and I suppose that could be specific to region. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think from the marketing standpoint, from this fall, right, I think some considerations are going to be interest cost, right, that we have to consider here as we move forward. What's your opportunity cost here on carrying corn versus soybeans? It's getting obviously much more expensive, right, with interest costs doing what they're doing at this point. And, you know, also looking at spreads here on corn starting to get close to returning a little more carry here to the market. What does that mean for marketing decisions moving forward? But I guess I'm still under $5, really not very excited about adding to sales at this point. Take my chances here as we move through harvest, see what yields look like, and look for some better opportunities post-harvest. But, you know, as I look forward to next year, I think some variables, obviously, we got to continue to look at, right, or what is the longer-term play on some of this export demand. Obviously, on the wheat side, we continue to see a struggle on export demand. Corn export demand, we've talked about here, it doesn't look very bright moving forward. Dave talked a little bit about what the ethanol numbers look like moving forward. I think there's going to be some opportunity still for some export demand on soybeans, and it looks like based on futures prices moving forward, beans are going to come back into play again next spring, especially as we move further out west, as we continue to hear more about biofuel investment, crush margins man, red hot again, and board crush margins continue to be hot again. And all we've all read about all the investment going on out west in terms of building bean plants. So as you look further west, I think beans are going to come back into play, especially if we continue to see beans hold up better than corn as we move into the spring. Because looking at the balance sheets, right, it does look a little more favorable for beans moving forward than it does for corn.
So either of you want to answer that question as well, or shall I go on to just the final thoughts?
Well, the other thing, just from a farmer standpoint, we've planted a lot more corn this year than we did on beans, and so the rotation's going to lean back on the bean side. I would think the Western Corn Belt will plant more beans.
Let's get a final thought from each of you. I'll start with you, Dave Chatterton at Strategic Farm Marketing.
Yeah, Todd, as we kind of, you know, look ahead to harvest here and kind of a transition into a new marketing year and a new crop year and you know, all the things that we've talked about here today, you know, keep in mind that, you know, there are some profitable opportunities out there. I think some of the things that we've talked about here may have been reflective of a few clouds on the horizon, but don't let that, you know, keep you away from what's been a very vibrant, a very profitable, but yet volatile market this year. I think the key here to kind of sleeping at night, or that sleep quotient for a producer, is to have a plan, to know your cost, and to execute on that plan along the way and take some risk off the table at levels that you think make sense. Right now, we've spent a lot of time talking about the old crop situation and what the new crop harvest might look like. If you look ahead into D's 24, I wouldn't fall asleep on that either. I mean, in corn, if you take, you know, we're looking at a futures price that's still at or near that $5 type of number. And if you take, you know, we know the production costs are down fairly significantly here year over year. We probably got ammonia costs down about almost 50%, P and K down about 30%. It's going to take the cost of production in central Illinois down $120, $150, maybe $170 per acre. And so, you know, if you run your math, you're talking about a break even on an $850 production cost and 220 bushel corn at $386 with futures trading above $5. So keep in mind there are ways to look at and to manage some of your risk and kind of eliminate some of this volatility and bumpiness that we've talked about, but you have to be ready to take those opportunities when they come.
Ellen Dearden of AgriView in Morton, Illinois, your final thought?
Keep in mind that volatility can be your friend as well as your enemy. And sometimes we have markets that jump up on an overnight market and act a little bit different. And then in the daytime markets, sell off. So make sure that if you're going to make some sales, have those offers in on the overnight markets as well as the daytime markets.
And finally, Aaron Curtis from Midco in Bloomington, Illinois.
We're getting into August now, so we're going to get into crop tours and those kind of things. And just keep in mind what you have coming out there. Keep an eye on those things. Obviously, last year gave us a little bit of a head fake here in Illinois, right? With a lot of crop tours looking for average crop, and we had a very favorable finish, and test weight really came through for us here. Illinois will root for the same again, but looks like pretty benign weather here as we move through August. So I think, barring any surprises, we're going to continue to struggle on corn and wheat on the upside here as we move into harvest and figure out what we got for yield. But I think we'll see some better opportunities, or hope to anyway, once we get past harvest or through harvest and past that time frame.
Commodity Week, of course, is a production of Illinois Public Media. You may find and listen to the whole of the program anytime you'd like. You can do that at willag.org. Our thanks go to our panelists, including Ellen Dearden of AgriView. She's in Morton, Illinois, Aaron Curtis at Midco in Bloomington, Illinois, and Dave Chatterton at Strategic Farm Marketing in Champaign, Illinois. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason.